and he was furious with himself. The man was in his sights, and yet he could not hit him. Then the man disappeared. 12. He had 20 cartridges left. He clicked out the cylinder and reloaded. He smiled at her as she came back. "You are most amazing," he said. She acknowledged this with a grave nod and turned her attention back to their enemies. Another rifle round shattered stone in front of him like an explosion. He bent his head against flying chips and felt a strange electrical pain all over his skull, a nerve pain. Then he couldn't see out of his right eye. He wiped at it quickly, and it cleared, and he watched for the smoke. He saw it down to the right again. She had probably hit the man with the handgun. The stream of water chattered busily down the ravine, and here and there shone like glass. The captain wiped again at his eye and then looked at his hand. It was wet with blood. A blade of stone blown off the rock had struck him over the right eye, but he thought it would stop bleeding in a minute or so. He must not be incapacitated. He must not be killed, because he knew very well what they would do with the girl. Some people were born unsupplied with a human conscience, and those people needed killing. He tried to think how many of them were wounded. He might have shot the Henry rifle barrel out of alignment. He thought he had hit the man on the left, but how badly he didn't know. Johanna had wounded another by tipping a rock down on him. He bent his head to his knuckles. His shirt was spotty with blood. He considered his choices. They could run for it, riding double on Pasha, get Fancy loose, and she would follow them. If they gained enough distance from Almay and the Caddos, he could stop long enough to put her on the mare, but Fancy was a dear, slow creature with her out-of-alignment front leg and prone to stumble. They could try to reach that distant smoke on the horizon. Johanna crept forward and brought the leather water bottle to him. The captain rolled onto his back and poured it down. Some ran down the sides of his mouth. He capped it. Almay and his evil minions had the spring water trickling down the ravine, but he and Johanna had only this one canteen. He handed it back to her. Useless thoughts again and again of why he had not carried more ammunition, why he had not bought more. Because they left Dallas in the middle of the night, that's why. Then the girl held out a wet cloth to him, and he took it and wiped his forehead and eye. Lucky it was his right eye, because it was his left eye that he aimed with. It was a shallow cut, but the blade of stone seemed to have hit a nerve, because it made a crawling, sharp pain all over his scalp. It didn't matter. He could see out of both eyes now. His vision was very good. The animals down below probably thought he was half-blind with old age. Well, surprise, surprise. He turned over on his stomach. After this little silence, they would be eaten up with curiosity. He caught a glimpse of a rifle barrel within range of the revolver. He laid the long 8-inch barrel in a notch. He fired carefully and listened happily to another shout of pain. "Captain," she said. He looked into her worried dark blue eyes. "My dear," he said, "let's face facts." He flipped open the cylinder of the revolver and turned his hand so that she could see it was empty. In his other hand, he held the remaining 14 rounds. She reached out for the shotgun and looked at him. "No good," he said, "no." He showed her one of the shells. Nothing but light number 7 birdshot. It would not even carry very far. He pointed toward Pasha, then he pointed to her. His bay saddle horse stood stiff as a china figure with fright, and his ears were rigidly fixed at full cock toward the ravine. The horse might prove difficult, but among the Plains Indians even young children could ride and ride well. "Go," he said. He made an away motion with his hand. "Go." He had made up his mind, and his expression was firm and unsmiling. They were calling up to him. They were trying to make a deal.
"Heine! Heine!"
No, she would not go.
"Get on the horse and go," he said.
He slid backward and got hold of Pasha's riding bridle from off the front wheel rim and held it out to her. The captain knew that with two of the men below wounded, she might have a chance.
"Damn it, go!" "Heine!"
Suddenly he felt very tired.
He could not deal with her and their attackers all at once. With his last 14 rounds clattering in his hand, he crawled again tight behind the lip of rock and found his notch. He loaded the cylinder and wasted 3 more shots trying to ricochet around into Alme, who was behind the buttress on the right-hand side. Then one of the caddos appeared, darting up the ravine and into cover again, and that caused him to uselessly expend another 2 shots. It was his judgment that was failing him as much as his strength. The only good thing was that the caddo had a bloody hand.
"Johanna, get on that horse and go!"
For a moment he dropped his head on his forearm. When he lifted it, there was a kind of bloody eye socket print on it. She had gone somewhere. He pressed the wet cloth against his eyebrow. Again the strange flashes of nerve pain all over his skull. Then he saw her crawling toward him with the shotgun in one hand and the shot box in the other. Somehow she had managed to stack the bag of coins on top of the shot box and shove that along, too. She was covered in dirt. He supposed he was, too. She pressed the bag of coins toward him and gestured down the ravine.
"Johanna, they are not going to be bought off," he said.
He patted her arm. Her hair was coming out of the braid, and it hung over her young, childish face in swags. He said,
"They can't be bribed. They are not going to be made to go away with offers of coin."
He looked into her anxious blue eyes, and a terrible thought came to him. He felt his eyes leaking tears or sweat. She could not be allowed to fall into their hands. Never. Never. He had 8 shots left, 6 in the cylinder and 2 in hand. He said,
"It won't work, my dear."
She pushed the shotgun toward him. He shook his head.
"Useless."
He opened a shell and poured the tiny lead beads out into his hand and showed her. Another shot from the left. It struck near one of the shafts of the wagon. The caddo had got his rifle again and was shooting, wounded or not, and the smoke told him the man had gained higher ground, more than 50 yards away. If he got above them and started shooting down on them, they were in serious, serious trouble. The captain watched for him, saw the bright shifting of black hair. He felt Johanna tugging at his sleeve. He looked down. She held up one of the shotgun shells. It was loaded with dimes. He stared at the shell resting on Johanna's outstretched palm. Then the captain reached out for it, even as another round smashed into the front of the stone in front of him. He jumped, but didn't duck. He lay back and hefted the shell. The dimes fit perfectly into the paper tube of a 20-gauge hull.
"Well, I'll be damned."
It was very heavy. He looked at the cap. She charged it with the powder charger. He saw her work the thumb lever that gave out 20 grains at a time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 80 grains of powder. A heavy load for his old shotgun. The captain tossed the shell full of dimes up and down in his hand and smiled.
"This is amazing," he said.
He laughed.
10 years old and a wizard of field expedients.
With the weight of the dimes and the powder charge, the shotgun had just become something like a small cannon. Not only that, but heavy things flew far and fast, and so it might give him a range of close to 200 yards. He couldn't stop laughing.
By God, he said.
They had a chance to get out of this. Everything had changed now.
Good girl, Johanna, good girl. My dear little warrior.
He did not notice that he stank of cordite and that Johanna's hands were white with flour and that both of them were coated with the red dirt of the Brazos country. The captain found that suddenly he was no longer tired. She smiled back at him with her bright child's teeth, and then the captain held up one hand.
"Wait."
She nodded. First, they had some ruses and deceptions to accomplish. He took one of the dove shot shells and loaded the old shotgun. As he laid the barrel into the notch, he saw her loading yet more dimes into shells, ramming in the wads with a stick, pouring out powder from the old spring-loaded charger, ramming another wad and finally twisting each hull firmly shut. He fired down the ravine and heard the light beads of Number 7 Dove tinkle harmlessly on the stone. Far below, Almay's laugh rang out. He called, "That's all you got?"
"Come closer and you'll find out, you son of a bitch," the captain called back. "I'm scared. You're shooting cake decorations or something at me,"
Almay shouted in reply.
"Well, come on then," said the captain.
He wondered where the caddos were, nursing their wounds, hopefully, or better yet, busy bleeding to death. He loaded another Number 7 and fired. It sprayed out its tiny beads into the air as if it had sneezed poppy seeds. He glanced at Johanna. She was busy stacking more dimes into hulls.
"Listen to me," said Almay.
He was still hidden behind one of the stone buttresses.
"I don't seem to have a choice," called the captain. "You should be good at a bargain. This ain't your first rodeo here."
They don't need to make a deal. He thinks everything is on his side. What he wants is to kill me and take the girl and the horses. They'll burn the wagon. It's too recognizable. Curative waters. He wants to get close enough to kill me without hitting the girl. He's not sure of his aim. He's shooting uphill, always difficult. He worked the bolt, and the old hull jumped out smoking, and she grabbed it. Now he slipped one of her dime shells into the breech. The weight of it should give him a good 170, 180 yards, if not more. He laid the barrel into the notch.
"What's your deal?" he called. "Reasonable. I can be reasonable. Come up. We'll talk."
The blond man held his hat out from the edge of the buttress. There was a hole in it.
"Captain," he said, "you was trying to hit me in the head here. That's serious malicious intent. We have some serious talking to do."
"So?"
"Listen to me," said Almay.
"You already said that. Stop repeating yourself."
"Now, let's make some kind of deal here."
Why was he delaying? The captain knew the only reason was to keep him talking while the caddos crept up. Far to his left, a small trickle of sand and rocks spilled down the ravine.
"Well, speak up, then," said the captain. "Stop your goddamn dithering. I hate dithering."
By now, Almay knew the range of the shotgun and its dove shot. He walked confidently out from behind his buttress of stone. He also thought the captain was out of revolver ammunition. Clearly, he was not shooting it and had reverted in his desperation to the shotgun and its pepper-light loads. Almay advanced up the ravine. Here and there, the water of Carlisle Springs had worn the red sandstone layers down to the strata below, hard and marble-like, white and pure and level. They were like irregular steps going down the ravine, carved through the eons, since Noah, perhaps. Almay carried his hat in one hand and took long steps to reach from one plate to the next in his knee-high boots. His hair was dark with sweat. They had ridden hard to catch up.
"I tell you what," Almay called. "You put down that shotgun, and I'll make sure my men empty their magazines and we can have a conversation."
200 yards, then a little closer. "Come on, come on."
"Certainly. I'm putting it down as we speak."
The captain aimed very carefully. He was not sure what the coins would do or the extra heavy powder charge. So he aimed for the V of Almay's open shirt collar and pulled the trigger. The dimes roared out of the muzzle at 600 feet per second with a muzzle blast 2 feet long. The gun smoke expanded in a great thick cloud, and the stock slammed back into the captain's shoulder almost hard enough to dislocate it. He struck Almay in the forehead with a load of U.S. Mint 10-cent pieces. As the coins flew out of the paper tube, they turned on edge, so that when they hit Almay's forehead, it looked as if his head had been suddenly printed with hyphens. The hyphens all began to spout blood. Almay fell backward, his head downhill. All the captain could see was his boot soles. He jerked off his hat and shoved it between the butt of the stock and his shoulder. Then, without turning his head, he held out his hand, and a dime-loaded shotgun shell was slapped into it. He shoved it in, shot the bolt home,
brought the sights to bear on the scrambling caddos. Another great bellow like a cannon, and silver coins hissed through the air faster than sight, and they sparkled and ricocheted all down the ravine. The roar of the overloaded 20-gauge sounded like a grenade had gone off. 10-cent pieces slammed edge-on into a wounded caddo's backside. A shower of bright flying money tore through the trees lower down and clipped branches and leaves of the live oak, spanged off stone, chipped the skull crown of the caddo in the rear so that he instinctively turned around to fight, and the captain unloaded on him again. Silver, like tearing sequins, sliced sideways through their blousy shirt sleeves and turned their hats into colanders.
"By God, I believe that was a good 250 yards, the captain said.
Finally, he leaned back against his red stone barbican. His nerves were glowing like fuses, and he was not tired any more.
"I got them. I did it. We did it."
She held up another shell, laughing and smiling.
"No, my dear."
He was sucking air. His eyebrow still hurt.
"We need the money to buy supplies."
He lay back against the rock, breathing slowly. Johanna jumped to her feet, standing straight as a willow wand. She lifted her face to the sun and began to chant in a high, tight voice. Her taffy hair flew in thick strands, powdered with flour, and she took up the butcher knife and held the blade above her head and began to sing.
"Hey, hey, Chalanon!"
Their enemies had run before them. They had fled in terror. They were faint of heart. Their hands were without strength.
"Hey, hey, hey! My enemies have been sent to the other world. They have been sent to the place that is dark blue, where there is no water. Hey, hey, hey! Koi gu, koi dui! We are hard and strong, the Kiowa."
Far below, the caddos heard the Kiowa triumph chant, the scalping chant, and when they struck the bottom of the ravine where it bled out into the Brazos, they did not even stop to fill their canteens. Then she climbed over the lip of rock with her skirts and petticoats wadded into Turkish pantaloons and the butcher knife held high. She was halfway down before the captain came after her and got hold of her skirt. She had been on her way to scalp Alme.
"No, my dear, we don't... It's not done," he said.
"Haina?"
"No, absolutely not. No. No scalping."
He lifted her up and swung her up over the ledges of stone, and then followed. He said,
"It is considered very impolite."
13. He reharnessed and took up all his small possessions from the tailgate, slammed it shut. He had to find a place to cross the Brazos soon. Going back downhill, the captain rode the brake. The shafts lunged up around Fancy's shoulders on the steep grade, and the brake chocks screamed on the axles. All the stuff in the wagon bed ended up in a heap against the back of the driver's seat, with Johanna tossed among the tools and food and blankets, holding the revolver. He had unloaded it, but she seemed happier with it in her hands. They were frayed and dirty. They both looked like they had been dragged through a knothole. As the wagon plunged downhill among the red rock and stiff brush, he prayed they would not break a tie rod and that the cracked iron tire would hold. They made it to the bottom and the road in one piece, with all possessions and horses still in hand. The captain's nerves were humming like telegraph wires in a wind, and he knew in a little while he would be close to collapse. He searched every copse of live oaks, and when they reached the Brazos, every shadow in the pecan flats. The road ran along the north side of the river, a shy and obsequious road that dodged every bank and lift and wound through the pecan trees and never insisted on its own way. He searched out every road bank ahead of him as they went. He was ready to shoot somebody else if need be. He must slow down. For Johanna, he needed to quiet himself. He must appear calm and assured. The caddos would bury Alme under a pile of rocks and quietly slip back into Oklahoma. Some day somebody would find the bones and wonder whose they were. Alme would run his child prostitution ring no more, his brains blown out by the coin of the realm. Hey, hey, hey. The captain's heart finally calmed. That night he dusted his cut forehead with gray wound powder, and then slept like a dead man without his usual war nightmares that should have been brought about by the fight, but somehow they passed him by. Perhaps they sought out someone else. Perhaps he was not on their map this night. He woke up to a clean and tidy camp under the pecan trees that stood high and airy above them. He heard the noise of a little stream nearby running into the Brazos and the hush-hush sound of small new pecan leaves in the breeze. He heard Johanna crying out, "Eat! Now you eat!" and the mare's bell ringing as the horses grazed. He took the plate from her and ate carefully. The blue smoke from the little stovepipe lay low and drifted. They were all right. He and the girl were alive. They were having a calm breakfast among the pecan trees, new leaves like green dots with their shadows making slow polkas back and forth over them and the curative water's golden letters. He pressed one hand to his right eyebrow. The cut was a little swollen, but all right. He could for a brief time work as hard as a younger man, but it always took much longer to recover. He must recover. They had far to go. The horses needed rest and care as much as he did. He would have to teach this to Johanna. The Plains Indians did not expend much care on their horses. They rode them hard and, as a last resort, ate them. He went down Fancy and Pasha's legs to check for swelling, but they were all right. They had last been shod up in Bowie, but before long they would need new ones. He straightened up again with some effort. He could almost hear the jointed sound as one vertebra settled on another. He sat on his carpet bag and leaned against a wheel. His mind kept going back to the fight, and to put it aside, he watched Pasha graze and drank black coffee and smoked his pipe. Johanna played in the stream like a six-year-old. She turned over rocks and sang and splashed. To comfort himself and slow down his mind, he thought of his time as a courier, a runner, and Maria Luisa and his daughters. Maybe life is just carrying news. Surviving to carry the news. Maybe we have just one message, and it is delivered to us when we are born, and we are never sure what it says. It may have nothing to do with us personally, but it must be carried by hand through a life, all the way, and at the end handed over, sealed. He was not really rested, but well enough. They went on. The next day at noon they came to a place called the Brazos Ferry. The Brazos unwound slow green coils, and smoke from slash fires lay low and drifted at the height of a man's head. There was no ferry. He could see the ferry landing on the other side, downstream about 100 yards where the current would push them. The landing looked good. It looked like a hard bottom. The river was up, so things might have changed. Loads of sand and silt could have been laid over the landing. Big tumbling drowned trees could be below the surface of the river, turning like the fabled octopus with grasping arms. Once again they had to make a crossing on their own, and once again he loosed Pasha and the little mare Fancy plunged in. She fought across the current. They drifted down. Johanna clutched up her skirts and prepared to jump, but they made it. On the far side they were on the Lampasas Road and would miss Meridian altogether. That was all right. They would soon come to Durand, which was larger and had more people, all of them with money in their pockets, he sincerely hoped. A brief rain, again it was a wet world where each leaf of the live oak, clinging to the twigs throughout the winter, held a drop at its tip. The live oaks never lost their leaves in the winter. He had seen them standing green in a snowfall. Johanna bent her head far back to look up into the leafy canopy and the rainy sky. There was a cautious wonder on her face. She said something in Kiowa in a low voice. So much water, such giant trees, each possessing a spirit. Drops like jewels cascaded from their spidery hands. He said, "Tree." He took off his old broad-brimmed field hat and ran his hand through his hair, which was as fine as cobweb and as white. Put the hat back on.
"Yes, Klee, Klee,"
he pointed out. "Pine, oak, cedar. First the general class, and then the specific.
Yes, Captain Kidd.
As they drove, he pointed back to Pasha, to his nose, to the bacon. She seemed to have had some acquaintance with the English language before. Maybe her memory just needed a jog. She said,
Hoas, Noza, Becken.
Then he rose to his feet.
Stand up,
she said. He sat down.
Sit down. Konta, sit down.
Captain Kidd was fairly sure Konta meant grandfather, but whether this was an honorific or a slang term, he had no way of knowing. He said, Konta, Opa.
Yes, yes, Konta Opa.
Opa, German for grandfather. Well, they were getting somewhere. The word Opa clicked into some otherwise disengaged gear in her mind. Then she became interested in the puzzle of another language, other words, other grammars. She thought for a moment and then said,
Chohenna klep hunts.
She clapped her hands.
Chohenna laffa.
She came out with a hearty false laugh, bouncing around on the wagon seat. Then she held up her hands with the fingers spread.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
The mouse ran up the clock, he said. And when he saw the dubious look on her face, her anxious need to understand, he patted her hand. It is all right, he said.
All right.
She could not pronounce either the German R nor the English R or one of the two TH sounds, and perhaps never would.
Lane, she said. Water. Plenty good much water. Plenty lane.
Excellent, Johanna. Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
She hummed to herself and rocked back and forth and then busied herself with tearing off the remains of the lace edging on her dress. She had begun it when she tied up her braid during the fight on the Brazos and had decided to finish the job. As long as they were traveling, she was content and happy, and the world held great interest for her. But Captain Kidd wondered what would happen when she found she was never to wander over the face of the earth again, when she was to be confined forever to her Leonberger relatives in a square house that could not be broken down and packed on a travoy. He had a failing feeling around his heart when he thought of it. Cynthia Parker had starved herself to death when she was returned to her white relatives. So had Temple Friend. Other returned captives had become alcoholics, solitaries, strange people. They were all odd, the returned captives, all peculiar with minds oddly formed, never quite one thing or another. As Doris had said back in Spanish Fort, all those captured as children and returned were restless and hungry for some spiritual solace, abandoned by two cultures, dark shooting stars lost in the outer heavens. And could he abandon her now to her relatives after they had saved each other's lives, after the battle they had fought? He had to. They were her blood kin. This was a painful thought, but he had had enough of anxiety for a good long while, and so he turned his mind back to the here and now. In Durand, he would have to give a reading of the latest news, since they had shot up nearly all their money. The captain's previous funds had been destroyed by the war between the states, and several minor debts in property taxes. But minor or not, they were debts, and by 1866 his deposits and bank stocks were all gone. The local San Antonio Commission for the Support of the Confederacy had threatened him with jail if he would not invest in Confederate bonds, and so there it all went. He sold his printing business and paid his debts and took to the road. Maria had died the year before, and it was as if some tether had been loosed. The anchor rope of a hot air balloon cut free, and the captain rose up and sailed away on the winds of chance. He was nearly 72 now, and his finest possessions were his gold hunting watch and Pasha and his reading voice.
Chohenna estomp chu!
She lifted her bare foot and pointed to it and then stamped on the floorboards.
Not shoe, foot, he said.
He reached back and found one of her shoes. He held it up, a black and confining laced thing with a blunt toe and a one-inch heel. The laces were missing. She had used them for something.
"Shoe," he said.
He pointed to her foot. Foot.
Very well. Johanna stomp foot. Johanna whiff hunt.
She waved her hand.
Captain, stand up.
He stood up.
Captain, sit down.
He sat down.
Captain, clip hunts.
He wearily clapped his hands.
Captain, laugh.
No, he said.
Ah, 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 Captain, please.
All right. He managed to raise a false and hearty laugh. Ha, ha, ha. Now that's enough for today. This made her fall into helpless laughter. Then she cried,
Captain, heat breakfast. Johanna, shoot gun.
Shooting noise.
Horse, trot. Captain, shoot gun.
Shooting noise again.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Very good, my dear. Now let's be quiet. I'm elderly and frail, and my nerves fray easily. His scalp still had the running galvanized crawl of pain, and his left eyebrow probably needed stitches, but was not going to get them.
Very good, Lane. Horse shoot gun. Ha, ha, ha. Horse eat breakfast. Horse laugh.
Here an imitation whinny. And she clapped her hands and laughed again, and so they went on down the Lampasas Road through the trees, toward Durand and the Bosky River, with the Kiowa captive girl inventing new and even more improbable sentences, and the captain's eyes watering with pain.
1 foot, 2 foots, 1 hunt, 2 aunts, 2 horse, big horse, little horse.
Johanna, shut up.
Johanna, shut up.
As they came within a mile of Durand through the dripping forest of live oaks, he saw men riding toward him. He put one hand out to Johanna. She stopped. She became perfectly silent. The men who rode toward them wore ragged clothing and shabby hats, but they were well armed. They had spent all their money on revolvers and the new repeating short-barreled carbines. Spencers. Gleaming new. The sun had come out, and the noon light outlined the men as they rode toward the captain's wagon. They sparkled with falling drops from the leaves, shakedown showers. The captain pulled up. He gazed at them with a steady and unperturbed expression. Behind it, he wondered if they had somehow got word of the great Brazos 10-cent shootout. He wondered what they wanted, where they were from. There was anarchy in Texas in 1870, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. One of the men with a trimmed black beard came up alongside the light spring wagon on the captain's side, and his cavalry stirrup with its blunt tapadero made chunking noises against the stopped forewheel. He looked down at them, at the cut over the captain's eye and the spots of blood on his shirt and the muddied wagon spokes. An old man and a girl. The girl had sunk down behind the canted dashboard, and only her dirty fingers gripping the wood and her face were visible. The man on horseback was dark-skinned and black-eyed, but this did not matter to Johanna. Native Americans looked not at the color of skin, but at the intentions, the body posture, the language of hands. That was how they stayed alive. Johanna fixed him like a print in her suspicious blue gaze.
Curative waters, eh?
He regarded the gold lettering on the sides.
I bought it from the proprietor, said Captain Kidd, who went bust.
He kept his voice within the range of reasonable tones. He had the girl to think about.
Did it have the bullet holes in it already?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it did, said the captain.
He tried to straighten out the wavy brim of his old hat. He had 2 days' growth of sparkling white beard and knew he looked like a derelict, but he sat straight-backed and tall in his canvas coat and fixed in his mind at the revolver on his left on the floorboards under the bacon. He said,
it came fully supplied with bullet holes.
Very curious.
And so, where are you headed?
Said the black-bearded man. His voice was low and rasping. Captain Kidd thought about it for a moment and decided to answer him. The scarves of smoke were coming from a campfire, one most likely belonging to these men, nearby, hidden.
Durand, the captain said. That's your final destination?
No. So where, then?
Castroville.
Where's that?
15 miles west of San Antonio.
That's a long piece of travel.
The temptation was great to say, "Why is it your concern, you filthy, ignorant brigand?" But he looked down at the girl and smiled his creased smile and patted her inflexible white fingers seized on the dashboard. He said, "This girl was a captive of the Kiowa, lately rescued, and I'm returning her to her relatives there."
"The savages," the man said.
He regarded the child, her hair stiff with dirt, skinned knuckles, and a dress smeared with dirt and charcoal and bacon grease where she had wiped her hands. He shook his head.
"Why they go and steal children, I will never understand. Do they not have area of their own?"
"I am as mystified as you are," said the captain.
The black-bearded man said,
"The Indians know as much about soap as a hog knows about Sunday."
"Miss," he said, "look here."
He fished in the watch pocket of his jeans and found a lump of saltwater taffy thick with lint. He held it out, bent from his saddle, smiling. Quick as a snake, she struck it from his hand and dropped farther down behind the dashboard.
"Ah," the man nodded. "They come back wild. I have heard about this."
The others had ridden around the wagon. They sat loose and easy in their worn dragoon saddles and did not bother to unlimber either revolver or carbine. Clearly, Johanna and the captain were harmless. The captain then understood they had not heard of the great Brazos 10-cent shootout at Carlisle Springs. It was 2 days behind, but a good bet was that these men did not travel much beyond this area. As yet, there was almost no telegraph service in most of Texas.
"Who you for?"
The black-bearded man turned to the captain. His manner had changed.
"Who'd you vote for? Davis or Hamilton?"
The captain now knew that disaster awaited any reading of the news in Durand, but they had shot themselves into poverty and had a long way to go. The only other thing he could think of to do was to sell the wagon and proceed on horseback. But his back and his hip joints were not strong anymore, and long distances on horseback had become increasingly painful. He said,
"I'm deeply offended that you would dare to ask who I voted for. We are guaranteed a secret vote. I'm a veteran of Horseshoe Bend and Resaca de la Palma, and I did not fight to establish a sleazy South American dictatorship. I fought for the rights of free-born Englishmen."
There, that should confuse them.
"I see."
The black-bearded man thought about it.
"Are you English?"
"No, I am not."
"Then this is not making sense here."
"Never mind that," Captain Kidd said. "Are you stopping me in some kind of official capacity? I'm about to lose my patience."
One of the others in a hat with a very tall crown said,
"Nobody who voted for Davis is getting into Erath County."
"Is this an official decision by the local administration?"
The black-bearded man smiled. He said,
"Sir, there isn't any local administration. There isn't any sheriff. Davis's men turfed him out. There isn't any J.P., there isn't any mayor. There aren't any commissioners. Davis and the U.S. Army threw them out. They all had been in the Confederate Army, or they were public servants under the Confederacy, and so that was it for them. But he won't send anybody to replace them. So we took on the job. You are accountable to us."
Captain Kidd glanced down at Johanna, who listened intently with her eyes blue and wide. He patted her fingers.
"For how much?"
A long pause.
"Oh, just give us a half dollar."
14. They pulled into the loading yard of a big broom and stave mill at the edge of the Bosque River. There were cottonwoods along the river, and their tiny new leaves shivered even without a wind and dripped rainwater in pinhead glitters. It was the first cottonwoods he had seen in a long time. The Bosque was shallow, and they had no trouble with the crossing. The undershot wheel that powered the machines turned and brought up bright squares of water and spilled them into the river. A man looked up from his binding work. He sat beside a broom-making machine amid a heap of broom-corn sheaves. A pile of handles lay nearby. He and his brooms were in a big cavernous building, open on the sides, with a shingle roof. It gave some protection from the sun and rain. The sky was laddered with passing waves of low clouds. Chickens stalked around and surveyed their world with calm yellow eyes. The captain asked if they could shelter here for the night. The man said, "There's a hotel." "I see," said Captain Kidd, "but I can't afford one right now." "There's a wagon yard." "It seems safer here. I have this child, you see. I can offer 15 cents for the night." The captain leaned forward and fixed the man in his old hawk's gaze. "I ain't that hard up."
"How hard up are you?"
50 cents. "You want to use the pump and give your horses some forage, plus these wood scraps to cook with and some of my straw to sleep on."
"Good God," said Kidd. "And cotton's going begging for 17 cents the pound."
"I ain't buying no cotton." Captain Kidd turned to Johanna.
"My dear," he said, "5 dima.
She dived into the shot box and found a shotgun shell, broke it open, and poured out the money. Captain Kidd washed up as best he could, tapped the cut over his eye with a wet cloth. He dusted it again with the gray wound powder. Then he tried to show Johanna on the hands of his watch when he would be back. She stared at the dial face intently and put her fingertip on the crystal, first over the hour hand and then the minute hand, and her eyes moved as she watched the second hand jumping forward like an insect.
"Time," he said. 2 o'clock.
"Time, Conta."
"When the little hand is at 3, I will be back."
Then he put it in her palm. He was almost persuaded that she understood. Then he dropped some more coins in the pocket of his old canvas coat and walked into town. The edges of his coat pockets were dark with grime. Soon he would have to throw the coat away and get another. When he was rich. Durand had a main street and board sidewalks. Otherwise the town was scattered out among the woods and the little rises. Cottonwood catkins had burst, and the silky cotton was drifting down the street and piling up in the corners of anything and anywhere. First he arranged for a reading space at the new mercantile building. It was very long and narrow, with glass cases full of knives, china shepherdesses, and silverware and handkerchiefs. On the walls were shelves of shirts and suspenders. Farther back were ready-made shoes and boots, work jackets, and bolts of cloth. The men's and ladies' underclothing were no doubt hidden below the counters. It would do. The man accepted his dollar in coins. He put up the handbills everywhere and was followed by urchins in galluses and straw hats, some with shoes, up and down the dirt streets of Durand. The captain said to leave him alone or he would twist their noses. He asked the tallest boy if he could read the bill.
"I could if I wanted to," the boy said, "but I don't care to."
"A man of independent thought," said the captain. "It says I am going to saw a woman in half tonight. A fat woman."
They hung back with dubious looks, and he walked on. He tacked his bills up at the livery stable, the school, the feed and provisions for man and beast, the wool warehouse, the post yard piled high with cedar posts, at the wagon makers and at the leather repair. He handed one to a man in a black sack coat and a vest and a pair of modest side-button black shoes. The man carried a gold-headed cane. He glanced down at the captain's riding boots. They were well made and showed it.
"Very good," the man said and lifted his hat. He read the bill.
"News. We have so little of it. Are you come from Dallas?"
"I am."
"And what are the conditions there with the Davis appointees?" Captain Kidd sensed danger, but he had no choice but to plunge on.
"I have no idea," he said. "I merely bought my newspapers, the latest come from the East."
"So you will read from the Daily State Journal?"
"I will not. It is mere propaganda."
"Sir!"
"It is opinion only. I refuse to be an unpaid mouthpiece for the powers in Austin."
Captain Kidd could not make himself back down. It was not a thing for which he had any aptitude, nor had he ever, and it was far too late in life to change. He said, "So understand this. I read of events. Events from places far removed, so that, indeed, they have a fairy-tale quality about them, and if you do not care for that sort of thing, then stay home." He stood over the man at his full height, dignified in his threadbare duck coat and his disreputable traveling hat. The man said, "I am Dr. Beavis, Anthony Beavis, and I do not consider the Daily State Journal to be composed of fairy tales. It is, in fact, a valuable contribution to the current debates." "I didn't say it was full of fairy tales, Doctor." Captain Kidd lifted his hat. "If only it were. Good day to you, sir." At the broom and stave mill, Johanna had busied herself with domestic chores. The man making brooms stared with narrow eyes at the blankets strung on lines and the harnesses flung over the gunwales of the wagon and the black beans and bacon simmering on the tiny stove. He regarded the curative water's gold lettering and the bullet holes with serious doubt. He said that the girl had taken the horses out to graze along the banks of the Bosque. "There's something wrong with that girl," he said. "And what would that be?" said Captain Kidd. He sat on the tailgate with his stack of newspapers beside him and a flat carpenter's pencil. He decided on different articles from the ones he had read in Dallas, something more soothing. He had the AP sheets with news of floods along the Susquehanna and railroad bonds being passed in Illinois to fund the Burlington and Illinois Central. Surely no one would object to railroads, per se. He had his London Times and the New York Evening Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, Milwaukee Daily News, the Cheese and Norwegian Tattler, as Captain Kidd called it, Harper's Weekly. He had Blackwood's, and then, of course, Household Words, out of date but good for any time, any place. None of them mentioned Hamilton or Davis or Negro suffrage in Texas, or the military occupation, or the peace policy. Captain Kidd hoped to get out of Durand with his finances refreshed and an unperforated skin. He had to. Johanna had no one else but himself. Nothing between her and this cross-grained, contentious white man's world that she would never understand. Captain Kidd looked up and enviously considered the chickens. So daft, so stupid, so uninformed. "Well, for one thing, she don't speak English." The man had a broom handle socketed into the hub of the machine, and he rotated it as he tied on wet bunches of broom corn. The fool sat there and did that all day long and probably considered himself an expert on the English language because it spilled out of his mouth like water from an undershot brain, and he didn't even have to think about it. "So?" "Well, she looks English."
"Do tell."
Captain Kidd drew thick lines around various articles in the Inquirer. "Must be careful here. Philadelphia meant Quakers, and Quakers meant the peace policy, which was getting people killed in North Texas, and even down this far south of the Red." He chose a daintily written fluff piece about ice skating on Lemon Hill, a spot apparently somewhere on the edge of Philadelphia. "Here, read and believe, they are building bonfires on this ice, and ladies are skating about on it. Their hoop skirts swaying. They are safe and life is quiet. The ice is firm and holds them up above the sinister and lethal depths."
"Well, what is she, then?"
The man's face was broad and low, like a soup tureen. Hens pecked at his feet.
"Here, Penelope. Here, Amelia," he said, in sweet, inviting tones.
He held down his hand, and the hens pecked broom corn seeds from it. Captain Kidd looked up in irritation. He was trying to care for a semi-savage girl child and fend off criminals who would kidnap her for the most dreadful purposes, and at the same time make enough money in the only way he knew how so they might eat and travel, and on top of that evade the brutal political clashes of Texans. A tall order.
"Why don't you just shut the hell up and tend to your brooms?" Kidd said. "I haven't asked you for your mother's maiden name, have I?"
"Listen here," the man said.
"Spare me," said the captain.
He opened Blackwood's. He closed his eyes briefly and asked for calm. Then, from beyond the rail fence that enclosed one end of the stave mill yard, he heard shouts and shrieks. He closed his eyes again. What now? What now? It was Johanna's particular Kiowa high-pitched continuous stream of tonal words, and a woman shouting in English. It came from the direction of the Bosky River. He threw down the carpenter's pencil and grabbed a blanket, for he had some idea of what might be happening. Johanna was in the shallows among the Carrizo cane, naked except for the tattered old corset and sagging drawers one of the ladies in Wichita Falls had given her. A woman with a wooden bucket in one hand was chasing her. They ran over the stones and shallow places, both of them spewing water. Johanna flung herself into a deep hole at the lip of a small rapids, screaming at the woman. Her wet hair was in dark ropes over her face, and you could see the row of white-bottomed teeth as she yelled. She was calling down the dark magic of her guardian spirit upon the woman, and if she had had the kitchen knife in her hand, she would have stuck it in this good woman of Durand. "We cannot have this!" the woman cried. She stood up to her knees in the current, and her dress skirts billowed up with trapped air. She was young and properly attired and outraged. "We cannot have naked bathing here!" She jerked off her bonnet and beat it on her thigh in frustration. The big live oaks lifted and sighed in exasperated sounds, and from the town came the sound of choral singing. Wednesday, choir practice. "Ma'am," said Captain Kidd. He saw the wedding ring. "Please, she was merely bathing."
"In public," the young woman cried. "Unclothed."
"Not entirely," said Captain Kidd. He waded into the shallows of the Bosky, boots and all, and threw the blanket around the girl. "Calm yourself," he said. "She doesn't know any better." Across the river was the wagon yard where the freighters camped, and several of the drivers had come to stand and watch and lean on their wagon boxes. Leaf shadows like laughter ran over their faces. Captain Kidd said, "She was a captive, an Indian captive."
"We can't have this," said the young woman.
She held on to the rope bucket handle with both hands.
"I don't care if she's a Hottentot. I don't care if she's Lola Montez. She was parading her charms out there in the river like a Dallas hussy."
Captain Kidd led Johanna out of the water. He said, "I'm returning her to her people by contract with the Indian agent Samuel Hammond of Fort Sill, official government business, Department of War." Johanna sobbed and leaned against him, ankle deep in the green water of the Bosky. He said, "Torn cruelly from her mother's arms at the tender age of 6, her mother brained before her eyes, starved and beaten, she has even forgotten her own language and the proper modesty of civilized peoples. Her sufferings were beyond description." The young woman paused, then fell silent. Finally she said, "Well, but she must be corrected. She must have this forcefully impressed upon her, about modesty while bathing." Johanna put her hands over her eyes. She could think only of her Kiowa mother, three-spotted, her mother's laughter, and how they had all dunked each other in the clear water of Cache Creek in the Wichita Mountains, and screamed and fell backward straight into the water. And far up the mountainside a group of young men drummed for the fun of it. They had waded and splashed down the clear currents, 4, 5 girls with strings of vermilion beads in their hair. She wept for them and for those mountains, a strange adult weeping with open hands and a bowed head, for all her terrible losses, which of a sudden had come back to her in a painful, wounding rush.
"Well, I'm sorry to hear it," said the young woman.
Her voice grew softer. And then, after a moment, she bent to Johanna and said,
"My dear, I am very sorry."
"Leave her alone," said the captain in a stiff voice. He lifted his hat to the young woman and took Johanna's hand. "And if you were to call yourself a Christian, you would find shoes and clothing for this girl, to supply her on her journey." They returned to the wagon, his boots full of water making squidging noises, Johanna, a dripping wad of coarse blanket and wet drawers bunched in her hands, barefoot, hurt, angry, despairing. By 8 o'clock it was dark in Durand, and he made sure she was bedded down in the wagon and in her nightgown, and the lantern lit. She hummed a slow and comforting song to herself and sat wrapped in the harongo, for which she had developed a strong attachment, and took up the task of sewing up the frayed edge of the gray wool blanket. She had put his blood-spotted shirt to soak in salty water. The captain went back to one of the stalls and pulled off his boots and spurs, changed into his reading clothes, put on the black lace-ups, and shaved.
"Beckin," she looked up when he walked out. "Heine Beckin."
"How very astute of you," he said. "I am, in fact, going to bring home the bacon." He put his portfolio under his arm. "I will astound the citizens with my informative readings concerning the Hottentots and Lola Montez and the Illinois railroads. They will pour out both silver and gold at my feet, and we will have not only bacon but eggs. How about that? First thing tomorrow, we will patronize the local establishments." He bent his head and regarded her with concern and some tenderness. It seemed his small warrior burst so easily into tears from time to time, and was soon afterward bright with energy and laughter. So it was with children. May she always be so. He arranged his black ascot and shot his cuffs. She nodded and sewed and raised her dusty blonde eyebrows a fraction as the gesture of a smile. Her freckles looked dark in the lantern light. He would have liked to kiss her on the cheek, but he had no idea if the Kiowas kissed one another, or if so, did grandfathers kiss granddaughters. You never knew. Cultures were minefields. He patted the air with a gentle motion. "Sit. Stay." 15. The mercantile filled up early. A U.S. Army soldier stood outside the door and required each man to open his coat and show he was not carrying a handgun. Some were. They were illegal, but the sergeant said nothing, only gestured toward a bench. By the time the mercantile was filled, there were 7 or 8 revolvers and one little two-shot Sneaky Pete on the bench. Men and some women sat in stiff-backed wooden chairs or stood leaning on the counters and were prevented from slouching against the glass cases by J.D. Allen, proprietor. Captain Kidd did not stand searching the faces of the crowd, but he saw them nonetheless at the edge of his vision. He laid out his newspapers and the AP wire sheets. He saw how they divided themselves, one group from another, and stared at each other with looks like warning flares. They sat and leaned and smoked, hatless among the articles of mechanical manufacture sent from far places. There were boots and shoes and suspenders and hair dye and buttons and ironstone plates from England. Kerosene lamps with green shades hung swaying from overhead chains, and in the distance thunder came toward them with threatening rumbles. The storm was coming from far beyond the 100th meridian. He began, as always, with his greetings to the establishment of the town and a brief comment on the roads. People always liked to hear about the condition of the roads from travelers. The captain said the roads along the Red were all good. He did not know about the Little Wichita. He had crossed it more than a week ago, but it might be up again. The Brazos Ferry was not operating, washed away perhaps, but the landings on both sides were good. The road from the Brazos to here was in good condition. He paused and with one veined hand flattened his papers, waiting to hear if anyone would mention an altercation there involving firearms, but that was not what was on the minds of several of his listeners. A hatless man stood up and cried, "When Davis gets done, there'll be a paved road to the house of every damn one of his cronies in the legislature." The captain's head came up. "Silence!" He had a very strong voice for a man his age, and he was over 6 feet tall and imposing in his crow-black clothes and his angry dark eyes, his brilliant moon-silver hair. His reading glasses flashed with gold rims as he stared around at his audience. The long, narrow room smelled of trouble. He said, "Sir, the people here assembled did not pay good money to come and sit here and listen to your complaints. I would suspect they have heard them before." Laughter. Captain Kidd cleared his throat, pressed back his glasses, and brought out the Inquirer to read of Lemon Hill. He slid out pages of the Tribune and its news of railroads, reading steadily, reading like a broom-making machine and sweeping all before him, except for a man who called out, "Why don't you read from the Houston Tri-Weekly Union, sir?" Another man rose to his feet.